So we're back at Blue Holler.
Yep.
We are.
Back at the Holler.
Back at the Holler. And we are drinking one of their new beers that is an actual Blue Holler beer called the Blue Holler Brown Ale. Is that what he's calling it?
Amber Ale.
Really nice beer. We're going to have Chris on here to talk a little bit about it. I think you talked to him earlier, so we're going to cut to that here real quick.
Yeah.
We're back at Blue Holler for the vinyl crawl, and I've got Chris here. How's it going?
What's going on, man?
Oh, you know, just another glorious day.
Another day, another 50 cents.
That's right. We do have a nice ice cold beverage in front of us that we are sipping on here.
Yeah, it's the Blue Holler Amber. It's one of the beers that's going to be released on the 28th.
Yeah.
When we do the grand opening for the brewery. So it's Saturday the 28th, about 2 o'clock. We'll have five or six. Not sure if the last one's going to come in time or not, but that'll be the beginning of the brewery. And hopefully, I want to say within a year to a year and a half, we'll have all 20 taps, just straight Blue Holler beers.
Yeah.
We'll have to see how Bowling Green can support that first.
Right. Well, that's an exciting time for Blue Holler for sure. To bring the brewery side of things into it.
Yeah, we've, for about 2 years now, we've been collectively saving and putting back and buying and crying and and blood, sweat, and tears. And, and it's all paying off now. My hands are even healing up, so it's getting close.
Well, an early congratulations on the brewery opening.
Thank you, sir.
Cheers to that. And tell us about this beer that we're drinking.
Well, it's pretty much just a straight up amber. I wanted to save all the crazy stuff for later and get some good beers in on tap right now. It's basically two rows. It's got a little bit of 77 crisp on the back end of it and some 80 caramel. Nice hop additions into it. So it's a little bit hoppier than most ambers, but it's not crazy over the top. It just gives it a little extra, little something on the back end.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, straight up amber, nice color, good sipping beer.
Yes, that's what we'll do with it.
You think?
Yeah, no, so we should have on the amber as well as our American Light Ale. Mm-hmm. We're making that one for the hot rod, so we'll be able to carry that here. And then it'll be on full time at any of the hot rod events. You can go there and pick up a Blue Holler beer.
Gotcha, that's cool.
Then we'll have the pineapple sour, a session, and a regular IPA.
Awesome.
That way we can kind of hit everybody's palates and start from there. So.
Yeah, awesome. Sounds good. Well, cheers. And congratulations to Blue Holler.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. It's good beer. Yeah, it's part of their new series for the grand opening of the brewery side of Blue Holler. So that's big stuff.
It really is. It's got, I think flavor-wise, it's got a lot of, it's a pretty round flavor to it.
Yeah.
Definitely have the notes of caramel and stuff that he was, you know, he was mentioning.
Yeah, definitely see that. Nice color to it.
Unfortunately, I don't know enough about some of the more technical aspects of what Chris was,
But if anybody, that's why we have him here.
Yeah, if anybody brews their own stuff, hopefully that was, you know, helpful.
Yeah,
because
for sure
he kind of went into pretty in depth there and everything
in
that's
depth.
In it.
Yeah,
which speaks a lot to how much is into craft brewing, like how many things go into it.
Yeah,
there's a lot of science to it and a lot of tweaking and whatnot that goes on to make it.
One wrong move
ruins a whole batch. Yeah,
pretty much.
But it's really nice. If you guys are in Bowling Green, I would highly suggest coming out on what day did he say it was? The
28th.
28th.
The grand opening.
July is the grand opening of the brewery. So so definitely come by and check it out because I think you'll really enjoy it. He said there was going to be three or four other beers as well that he's got. So, but on to the record that we're talking about today. It is a favorite of mine and yours. I don't know for maybe the younger crowd listening. I don't know how much they know about it, maybe because it tends to fly under the radar. I think.
Yeah.
It's the it's U2's The Unforgettable Fire, and it is the bridge from their early new wave post-punk sound into their later, more pop-oriented, pop rock, I guess, oriented sound of of Joshua Tree and post Joshua Tree.
Right. Yeah.
So it's a transition record.
Very much so.
And sometimes those can go wrong with a lot of bands when they try to transition from one known style to another. Yeah. Like there's lots of instances where, let's use The Who for an example, when they tried to transition into the 80s using what was the name of the record? I can see it.
Face Dances
and the what was the other? Had them all on the front there. That kind of have like computer font.
Oh yes.
I'm trying to think of the name of it.
Yeah.
It basically is everything after The Who by Numbers. Everything post that was the transition into them trying to make something in the 80s.
Yeah, I don't know if they ever made it.
They didn't.
I think they're still trying.
Spoiler alert, they didn't.
Yeah.
But it just goes to show that when a lot of bands try to transition to a different sound, they don't always get rewarded for the experimentation.
Yeah.
A lot of times it blows up in their face. They lose money. They lose fans.
They can't create that sound in their head that they're talking about.
I mean, we could use the Grateful Dead as an example of this. They had many transitional periods.
Yeah.
Where they tried different styles. You know, Shakedown Street was not an instant success.
No.
It didn't garner the notoriety it has now that people enjoy so much. Yeah, but at the time, it was seen as like, what is this?
Disco Dead.
That's Disco what Dead. It is. Right. Or even Touch of Grey when they went into a more slick, polished.
I think that kind of worked, though.
I think Shakedown Street worked.
I did, too.
That's the thing, but
Go to Heaven, not so much.
Right. But the deal is, like, a lot of the times, longtime fans that are looking for a certain sound get disillusioned when the band tries to go a different route. Because, I mean, let's face it, you get tired of playing the same music all the time as a band. You want to, and you should want your bands to try different things.
Right.
So yeah. I kind of have a hard time with people that tend to get disillusioned with a band when they try something new.
Yeah.
But in regards to Unforgettable Fire, basically they decided they didn't want to make War Part 2. War was a huge record for U2. They toured the world on it.
Yeah.
Sunday did. Bloody Sunday was a huge hit. They put out the Live at Red Rocks album right after that.
You know what band opened for them at Red Rocks?
Hold on. I do. Because I know we've talked about this before.
We have, yeah.
Was it The Alarm?
It was The Alarm, yeah.
I was kind of shooting in the dark a little there, but your love of The Alarm knows no bounds.
Yes.
So I had to assume that was probably going to be the right answer.
Yeah, it was The Alarm. I think that might have been, I don't know if that was their first.
Could have been. Because we're talking
tour,
82.
I think it was, yeah.
So it very well could have been.
Yep.
But War was huge. You know, it had Sunday Bloody Sunday. It had
New Year's Day.
It was New Year's Day on War. I couldn't remember if that was.
Was Seconds on there? I don't know.
There 40. There was a whole, yeah, there was a whole thing. And
it was a great album. War was a great.
Fantastic album, but very much in the new wave post-rock, post-punk kind of vein.
Yeah.
It was closer to what their contemporaries like The Police and bands like that were doing at the time. With really intense rock music and
a touch of that protest,
anger,
you know.
Which moving from there, I guess the band decided we're either going to kind of, like, Bono started hinting to the fans, we're going to break up and reform, was how he worded it, which is a terrible thing to say.
Yeah.
But basically what he was trying to tell them is, when we come back with the next record, you're not necessarily going to recognize us.
Yeah.
So they go into the studio and they decide, hey, we don't want to go with Steve Lillywhite, who's been producing all of our other records. Fantastic producer. They get along with him fine, but they're like, we just don't want that Steve Lillywhite sound, because he's got a method, and his method works. It's made a lot of bands famous. Dave Matthews Band, for example, has been one that had some really famous Lillywhite recordings.
True.
But they decided we don't want to go with him. We want to go a completely different route. So they decided we want Brian Eno. So that was a lot easier said than done. At that time, Eno was beginning to become really well known for his ambient work, for his more experimental work. He had already made it through the Roxy period of the 70s,
yeah,
and his own solo rock music period of the 70s, and he was starting to work more with Daniel Lanois as his engineer, and they were doing more of the soundscapes.
Is that how Lanois kind of got his start?
I think so, because you know that Apollo record came out in maybe like 80 or 81,
yeah,
I want to say.
Yeah.
And that's credited as Eno and Lanois.
Okay.
Lanois was working as his engineer, though.
That's the earliest time I remember seeing Lanois's name.
Well, he was super young.
Yeah.
He was,
true,
you,
yeah,
know, a young Canadian, so, upstart at the time. Yeah. I'm not sure if he had already played with some bands, and maybe that's how he got involved, but because he had a very successful solo career as well later on in the 80s, Lanois did. Very successful to a degree.
Well,
still.
I mean,
check out For the Beauty of Winona or whatever.
Even that, the album before that,
yeah,
that had the Maker on it.
Yeah, just check them out.
Yeah.
They're great. But
yeah,
I digress. So they find Eno. Eno listens to War and goes, no, I'm not going to. It just doesn't do anything for him. He's
right.
Like, I don't see what this is. I don't see how this is going to be any fun for me or them, either one. Because Eno is somewhat of a perfectionist. He is very interested in experimentation. He's not interested in any kind of linear theme. He had just finished working with Bowie not too long before that. So they had just done their sessions for Heroes. That was in 78.
Oh, yeah.
So we're talking like 4 or 5 years away from that. So he's still in a very experimental phase, which Eno has never left his experimental phase.
No.
But regardless, he meets with the band. They're like, you know, we're serious. We really want to change our sound. They had seen this exhibit while they were on tour about Hiroshima, this art exhibit, and it kind of changed all of them. And they wanted to get super serious about their writing and about their music. So they talked to Eno, and Eno's like, okay, so it sounds like you guys are serious, so I'll go into the studio with you. So they hold up inside of Slane Castle, yeah, in 84, and start recording in this giant castle, and they basically just live and record there for months. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, and we talked about that documentary,
right,
on,
yeah,
it too,
which everyone should look up. It's on, yeah, it's on YouTube. It's really short. It's maybe 30 minutes, but they had a director that documented some of the recording process of the band with Eno and Lanois at Slane Castle.
And that's kind of ahead of its time, too, to have an in-house,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely,
person there to film what they really don't know is going to be the outcome.
And we could even see it as a, you know, U2 is always a very visual group. They've always...
Yeah,
they've always leaned towards that, and we could see this as maybe a precursor to like Rattle and Hum and things like that they would do later on.
Yeah,
but this is the U2 in that documentary is a completely different U2 than what you see later in the 80s. They are very soft spoken,
mm-hmm,
very unsure still. Now I will say that Bono's ego was out of control at all times. Like seriously, there's a quote. This quote from Bono is one of the craziest things I've read. It's like so egotistic, but it's still the truth, so you can't like fault him for it really. But the quote is, it was about Unforgivable Fire, and he said, "We knew the world was ready to receive the heirs to the Who." So he's already putting himself and the band as the heir apparent to the Who, right?
Yeah.
And then he said, "All we had to do was to keep doing what we were doing. We would become the biggest band since Led Zeppelin, without a doubt." Okay, so now you've already said you're heir apparent to the Who and the biggest band since Led Zeppelin.
Well, just playing devil's advocate.
Was he wrong?
I mean, is that egotistical or confident?
I don't
know. Because we know the end result. I mean, it's not that far off.
It's really not that far off.
Honestly.
But the second half of the quote is what I think makes him go, okay, well, I don't think he's just being an asshole. I think he really means it, because he says, But something just didn't feel right. We felt we had more dimension than just the next big anything. We had something unique to offer. The innovation was what would suffer if we went down the standard rock route. We were looking for another feeling. So it's like, by taking that quote and thinking about what he's saying, on the outset, it's like, damn, dude, you're just going to put yourself up there on the Mount Rushmore of rock music.
Yeah.
But what he's really saying is, like, we just don't want to be that. We don't want to be the next Led Zeppelin or the next The Who. We want to be U2, and we want to do our own thing. I had to reread that quote two or three times because I was like, you know what?
To digest it a little bit.
But he's kind of telling the truth. They were that big at the time. They really...
Yeah, I mean...
I mean, what was the concert where they did Sunday Bloody Sunday and he grabbed a flag and everything?
That was Red Rocks.
So...
Yeah,
and you know, he'd already shown he could, like, command a crowd, right? Like, he'd already shown that...
Oh, totally. And that was kind of the beginning of it, really.
Right.
At that Red Rocks. And that was just by chance because they had already... postponed the concert because of heavy rains.
Oh yeah.
And then I think the Alarm maybe went out and played a little bit, and then they were going to film it and everything, and Mike Peters was supposed to come out and sing Knocking on Heaven's Door or something like that
yeah.
with you two as an encore. And so they decided to go out and play, you two did, and they hit record on filming. And it was going so well, they kept straight filming it and didn't disrupt anything by having Mike Peters come out.
Wow.
So it was just
I don't think I ever knew that.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome.
But to me, that was probably the beginning of U2's climb. You know, they had taken that next level.
How old were you when that was?
What was that, 83 or 82?
That would have been 82 or 3.
Yeah, 12.
Probably 82.
12.
So had you already
yeah,
or maybe, well, were you a bit too young to fully take in, like, you two?
Oh yeah, I mean, I was definitely, because
they were pretty
young.
Heady then, like,
yeah,
was,
I mean, I knew New Year's Day and Sunday Bloody Sunday and all that.
Yeah.
But definitely by the time 84 hit with Unforgettable
then
Fire,
you were really hitting your teens.
Well, and it was MTV, and so,
right,
you know, Pride. And then, of course, Live Aid. We're jumping ahead a little bit, but Live Aid.
That's the other half of the story is Live Aid. So they go in with Eno. They got Lanois as the engineer, and they you just started talking about Pride. Pride is easily the highlight of the record. It was the biggest single on the record. Let me see what it charted at. Surprisingly, didn't chart as high as I thought it would.
No, yeah, I don't remember it. Of course, if it was 84, it also got caught up in the land of Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA.
Yeah.
Michael Jackson was still, you know, I mean, even Madonna, I think. So there was a lot. Prince,
yeah, it only,
Purple,
like,
Rain.
Pride made the UK top five, but it only cracked the top 40 in the US, which is wild, because you can't go anywhere now and not hear it. I mean, it's on every radio, every classic rock radio plays it.
Right. That's one of their...
It's a staple.
Biggies, yeah.
Yeah, it's ubiquitous with classic rock radio.
Yep. Which is funny, classic rock radio.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, there's Pride, which is absolutely the highlight, and it's what they spent the most time on.
Mm-hmm.
They really struggled with Pride, because I think that... I know from watching the documentary, they said, and before I forget, in the documentary, you know, you were talking about all the other bands that were becoming big at the time. There's a great scene where they got a guy in with a violin that's, like, plucking some strings and whatnot for the Unforgettable Fire song.
Yeah.
And he starts playing this little bit, and he says, oh, that's starting to sound like Flock of Seagulls. And Larry pops in the camera and says, cut that out of this. Don't put that in there. We're not going to be Flock of Seagulls, which was kind of funny.
That is funny.
But, yeah, so they start working on Pride, and Bono gets the idea of, I want to make this song about Reagan's America.
Yeah.
But then he reads this this book about Martin Luther King, and I can't remember what the book name is, but it kind of changes him.
Mm-hmm.
And makes him do a deep dive into the civil rights movement and America's history with the civil rights movement. which would probably be fairly new information to him at the time, seeing as they're from Ireland. They're not from here.
Well, and they hadn't, at that point, they really hadn't spent a whole lot of time in America.
Right.
You know, so they were still kind of taking it all in.
And, you know, they had their own conflicts going on in Ireland that were separate from our conflicts in the United States. So so he takes a deep dive into Martin Luther King, and this album almost becomes a bit of a protest record. There's a lot of themes in here. Mm-hmm. While he doesn't directly denounce anything, or he doesn't directly take a hard stance on anything, I guess you could say, the lyrics float in and out of topics that are very like topical of the time. There's no like there's no like Billy Bragg to it. There's no, you know, everybody rise up and stuff.
Right. Yeah.
But the pride in the name of love chorus is so bombastic and huge. It's almost like a rallying cry for love instead of hate.
Right.
And for being proud of love and proud of what you stand for, that sort of thing.
It's almost like this album and these songs were the kind of beginnings of that side of U2.
Yeah.
As far as getting a little bit more political or what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of civil minded.
Yeah. Yeah, he hadn't started any of his civil service stuff yet that he, you know, that he started later on. Even with, like with the one campaign they're still doing now.
Yeah.
He hadn't started that route at all. Of course, they were still young. They were young, young guys.
Super young. And, you know, love or hate Bono, he is a good person as far as he does a lot of work.
Yeah, his head's always, like, his head's always in the right place. It's just the way he goes about doing things sometimes can leave a bad taste in some people's mouths.
Yeah.
That's neither here nor there on this album. But let's talk a little bit about the songs on the record other than Pride, because Pride's the big one. Pride took forever for them to record. It took forever for them to get the vocals down on.
Mm-hmm.
Bono still says it's an unfinished song, so take that however you will. I think it's pretty well finished.
I think it's pretty well finished.
Now, we talked about the album on the whole feeling a little unfinished, because there's a lot of experimentation, a lot of open-ended things going on, a lot of just jamming on, like, Larry Mullins and
a lot of ambient sounds.
Who's the bass player? I can't.
Adam Clayton.
Adam Clayton. Larry and Adam kind of jam a lot on here. You can hear them without a lot of guitar on certain parts.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of that goes on in it, especially like on 4th of July and Promenade.
Promenade. I feel like that the Edge. This was like the first time where that Edge sound kind of started.
I know a lot of people shit on Edge for like how he plays guitar. It's a known quantity. A lot of people just say he plugs in a bunch of effects and then hits one chord and that's the end. I would tell them to listen to Wire.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And then like you go play that.
Yeah.
And make it sound the way he makes it sound.
You know, I mean, you can talk shit about him, but when you hear him, you're like, oh, that's the Edge.
He's an amalgamation of a lot of different sounds. He's the David Gilmour delay sound. He's the guitar player for the Skids in Big Country. I can't think of his name.
Oh, yeah.
Stuart, his last name. I can't think of it. He's an amalgamation of that kind of post-punk sound. Maybe a little bit of the guitar from Susie and the Banshees, like a little bit of that rhythmic aspect of it.
Because
a lot of them... That was one thing that Edge, on New Year's Day, he was trying to capture some of that guitar sound that they had on Susie and the Banshees. So he's an amalgamation of the 80s sound that he's taken little pieces of and made his own.
Mm-hmm.
And it is his sound.
It is his sound.
It might be driven heavily by effects, but it's still his sound, and he's still playing it and making those things happen. So I think Wire is an incredible guitar song.
It really is.
And
you know, the album starts out perfectly to me.
It's one of the all time best album starts.
Yeah.
Ever.
A sort of homecoming.
And it also shows them this is not the war U2. From the first notes of A Sort of Homecoming, it does not sound like the last album.
They are rolling out their new sound. And
absolutely.
Who they will be from here on out, pretty much.
True, very true.
And they've, with that first song, like, there's proper placement for Pride.
Yeah.
And it, or for that matter, the whole album was sequenced very well. It's very smart, you know, as far as putting those little, I don't know, interludes, maybe.
It does. It does have some, like, some more experimental interludes,
yeah,
to it.
Yeah, it helped, like, you know, side two, you've got 4th of July that runs into Bad. Mm-hmm. That's the perfect just kind of intro or interlude to Bad.
Which is, you know, Bad is, I will say the album version I really enjoy, but it's nothing compared to that live version from Live Aid.
No, and honestly, that became a concert staple for them.
It's such a great song, and it just builds and builds and builds and builds and builds.
And that's the mark of a great song, if it comes across better live, at least in my eyes.
Well, and the reason it was a turning point on Live Aid was because he gets out and dances with the girl during it.
Yeah.
And that was like a huge thing.
Yep.
Because he just pulls a random girl out of the crowd and like slow dances with her to Bad. Which is pretty wild.
Wasn't planned. But, you know, even last year when they were doing the Joshua Tree tour. Mm-hmm. So them playing Joshua Tree from start to finish is incredible, but they also played Bad and Pride. But seeing Bad, even, you know, X amount of years later, it's still a showstopper.
They're still a great band. They've never stopped being a
goosebumps.
Great band.
Yeah.
And I think they still enjoy playing those old songs too, especially one like Bad that came from this experimental period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so yeah, like there's, the way the album works is there's singles in a way. They're not really singles. They're all kind of experimental. But there's songs that have better structure, and then there's more like avant-garde, just kind of floaty pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of Homecoming, which is probably like a top five U2 track for me, honestly.
I love that song.
I can almost put that song on repeat and just loop it because it's a song that doesn't have a clear structure to it, really. It kind of just floats around.
Yeah.
The bass and drums kind of just float around, and the guitar does its own thing, and Bono just kind of scats a lot of the vocals in a way. But it's so good.
It is.
It's so good.
And it sets a tone for the whole album, basically.
It really does. Yeah, the sound you hear on Sort of Homecoming, you hear throughout the whole record.
Yeah.
And you do hear a little bit of that Daniel Lanois sparkle, too.
Mm-hmm.
That we've talked about in the past on other podcasts, especially with Bob Dylan.
Oh, Mercy.
Oh, Mercy, man. That you got to get that sparkle from Lanois. Yep. So Sort of Homecoming, Pride, which, of course, Wire, Unforgettable Fire, the title track. Man.
Great.
What a stunner that song is.
The side one is, top to bottom, pretty solid.
Yeah. Apparently, it didn't do well in the States. That track didn't, which is funny now because you'll hear it on the radio all the time now. It's like it's a classic rock staple once again. It charted really well in the UK. They released it in 85 as a single, and it made a top 10 hit in the UK. It was their third ever top 10 for U2, but just didn't do anything in the States.
No.
There's also something I thought was interesting was the track on side two, that Elvis Presley in America.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, you know, it's not the best song. Honestly, it falls under itself a little bit, under the weight of itself just a touch.
Mm-hmm.
But what's neat is it is a improvisation based on slowed down backing track from A Sort of Homecoming. So they slowed down A Sort of Homecoming and played over it. And that's what that track is. And if you go back and listen to it, you can kind of hear it, which is interesting.
That is.
Of course, there's Bad that we've talked about as well. But then you get the album Close, which is also one of the best album closes.
Yeah. It kind of is perfect. It's just great bookends with A Sort of Homecoming in MLK.
Yeah.
But also maybe leaves a little continuation as to what's to come.
I think so, yeah. It doesn't end on like a finality. It ends on like this chapter is moving.
Right.
And maybe that's what Bono meant with the unfinished quality of it. Maybe that's why he felt it.
Yeah.
But MLK is just a, it's a meditation on Martin Luther King, mm-hmm. basically, over some really soft synth playing.
Yeah.
And it only lasts 2.5 minutes. It is very tasteful. Yeah. I did read something that said, where Bono said this was his more, this was his beginning to be a poet, period. This was when he felt like he started writing poetry instead of just words on paper.
Hmm.
Now the band all consider themselves, because they were still religious at this point. They'd already, you know, they were still doing their Christianity religion thing. And he said he considered them as a conduit. So everything they did, he felt like was coming through them from a higher power.
Yeah.
So he, so it gets a little heady, but so he didn't want to write too much because he said he felt like he was getting in the way of the conduit if he wrote too much.
Yeah.
He wanted to keep it as simple as possible. Take that as you will, however you like. But another interesting fact is Chrissy Hynde is on Pride on the backing vocals.
Mrs. Kerr.
Yeah, Mrs. Kerr. That's strange, isn't it? Also, Peter Gabriel did some did some vocals on sort of Homecoming on a remix version.
Probably comes from Eno, wouldn't you say?
I'm sure he or Lanois, either one. Lanois worked with Gabriel as well. Yeah. But yeah, Eno and Gabriel had a working relationship. Yeah. Didn't Eno produce maybe like the third record?
Seems like it.
Maybe Security or something like that. Yeah, but absolutely. Yeah, it makes sense for him to be on there. I'm sure he just probably stopped by the studio one day or something. And then they're like, hey, you want to sing a little bit?
Yeah.
You know, why not have Peter Gabriel on your album?
Can't hurt.
So let me ask this question. Where do you put this record in the pantheon of U2 albums?
Oh, wow.
Because this is a really tough question on this one.
It is a tough question. I feel like this is probably U2's most important album in their whole discography for the fact that it created that U2 sound that we now know.
Yeah.
And it's what took them to the next level, that superstar level. That
right.
There would be no Joshua Tree without this, which we know what Joshua Tree did for them. That pretty much put them into a whole different
And we should just mention, if you don't know already, this is the predecessor to Joshua Tree.
Yeah.
This is the one before, as it may.
Yeah.
And which Joshua Tree is just... It's almost become its own thing at this point.
Yeah.
Like, it's not even...
Well, when you do a tour just based on an album.
It's its own thing now.
That kind of... But where do I put it? I put it pretty high up there. I mean, to me, you know, Joshua Tree's 5 stars. This is probably 4.5.
I completely agree with you on that.
I love War. I love... I don't know if you can consider Rattle and Hum an album. About half of it was probably original and not live.
Probably depends on who you ask if they consider Rattle and Hum an album or not.
You know,
a lot of people really don't enjoy Rattle and Hum. We are not part of that crowd, but a lot of people really don't enjoy
it. That's kind of my stopping point. I mean, Octoon Baby.
Right. See, that's where me and you really, like, that's where our paths really start to...
I'm not saying I don't like... Post Rattle and Hum.
Oh, it's okay. I know you don't.
I like some of it.
Yeah.
There's a really good album's worth of material, but no.
All those years post just one album's worth.
But I love the early stuff for its punkish quality.
Can you spit out like a top 5 U2 albums? Can you like?
Oh yeah.
Could you quickly put them in order?
Yeah. Probably Joshua Tree. Are we going to include Rattle and Hum?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I include it.
Joshua Tree, Unforgettable Fire, probably War, Rattle and Hum, October, or Boy.
You ready for my hot take?
I am. I'm sorry. I've been hogging the mic.
No, dude, I've been hogging the mic this whole podcast. I was talking about my hot take for the top 5.
Do it.
Joshua Tree.
Yeah.
I don't think that it's uncontested.
Yeah.
If somebody doesn't have Joshua Tree as their number one U2 album, you need to have a conversation with them.
I texted a good friend of mine, Lori, who absolutely loves U2.
Mm-hmm.
And we listened to, nonstop in the 80s
yeah.
in school. Her favorite is Unforgettable Fire, hands down, okay. she said.
All right, I'll say this. If there one isn't Unforgettable Fire or Joshua Tree.
Right.
So I'm going to match you on Joshua Tree and Unforgettable Fire is one okay. and two. I think that's an easy sure. one, too.
Yeah.
My third is Octung Baby.
Yeah.
I just love that record. It's so much fun. And like
it is a great album.
Your experience of being 12 when this stuff was coming out. Mine was, I was 10 and 12 when Mysterious Ways came out.
Yeah.
And I was just like, wow, it just blew me away. Cause it just didn't sound like anything else really that I had heard, especially from you too. Like I knew Where the Streets Have No Name as a yeah. kid. Everybody knew that sure. song. It was on the radio constantly. But when you hear Mysterious Ways for the first time and hear that guitar sound, it's for a kid.
Yes.
Let me yeah. put that in perspective for yeah. a kid, because I'm sure at your age, at that time, you had already heard a lot of things that sounded similar to that.
Yeah.
But as a kid, listening to the radio, I hadn't heard anything that had that yeah. crazy of a sound.
Well, in that time period, too.
And that time period. Yeah. Or even like One, when One first came out. Oh, I was like,
yeah.
man.
Yeah.
What a huge song. Like, massive. There's a lot happening in this massive. Song. And then the tour that supported Octung Baby as well.
Yeah.
That was huge. And, you know, the prank calls to the president, things like that. Those I loved those things as a kid.
Right.
I thought
yeah.
that was the best thing. Even the Wayne's World bit that was on
yeah.
on there where Garth played even better than the real thing on yeah. the drums. I loved all that stuff. So that's three. So Octung Baby's three.
Yep.
Four is probably going to be War.
Uh-huh.
Five's a tough one, man.
It is tough.
Because, you know, I even really like some of the later albums a lot. Like, what was the one that, was it How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb? Was that
oh,
the one?
Oh, yeah.
That?
Yeah.
That's a really good album.
Don't leave out Zooropa.
I don't like Zooropa. See, that's the thing is I can't. I'm like you with that. But I can't go past Octung Baby and be yeah. happy.
Yeah. I mean, Octung Baby should probably
be Rattling Home. Rattling Home would be five.
Yeah.
There we go.
I feel bad for leaving out Octung Baby, but I heard it so much.
I think it's fair that you leave it out because I know it's one of those records that, like, you've just heard so many yeah. times. It'd be like another example is like Lynyrd Skynyrd. We all know that first Lynyrd Skynyrd record is amazing. But we're not going to go just listen to it because we just heard it so yeah. many times. So I'd put in the same boat as that.
Yeah.
So I'm going Rattling Hum is a U2 record.
All right.
Is number I like five. It. So cheers, man. Have a good one.